It's a great privilege to welcome Jim Aldridge to introduce our speaker. And
thanks. As he said, I'm Jim. I'm from the Inglewood Church in Indianapolis. We're always casting about for books to read. At some point in time, none of us know how, we wound up with a book on our desk called Till We Have Built Jerusalem by a guy named Philip Best. None of us had any idea who this was. We have a really good idea now. We're pretty excited to know him and to have him here this week. Philip was he was raised a suburban Southern California Baptist, but is now an urban Chicago Catholic. He's been here for a long time. He taught from 1993 to 2003 at Andrews University in the School of Architecture. He's now the Director of Graduate Studies at Notre Dame University in Architecture and has been since 2004. Last year he had kind of off. He was doing a big project for which they just won an award from the Congress for New Urbanism, and he gets to go back to work at school this in the next month or so. Both of those two schools share a commitment to traditional urbanism and to architecture as a civic art, and that is held by the faculty and is embedded very much in their architectural curriculum. His training was in philosophy, theology, and architecture. He came to architecture lately, so he's got quite a background, and it shows. He notes that many observant and practicing Jews and Christians seem to act with, or at least acquiesce in, modernist assumptions about the built environment, and finds such assumptions problematic insofar as they seem to undermine the professed beliefs and purposes of both neo-traditional urbanists and communities of biblically based faith. It's in working out that tension between professed beliefs and purposes and the modernist assumptions that we were formed in and by that Mr. Best is so important to us at Inglewood. He makes the case that many religious believers embedded this in suburban sprawl compromises their religious and communal objectives. But he does so without demonizing suburbanites or taking gratuitous whacks at McDonald's. He does offer us ways forward. We really appreciate that. We need that. We look for that. Projecting several potential outcomes of our current emotivist culture, he proposes initiatives especially suited to communities of faith. Of particular interest to us is the idea of moral communities doing development for reasons other than maximizing returns on real estate holdings. He identifies such communities as founders and reflects that this has historically been a common role for Christian communities. Even before we got into the book, we knew we had something different on our hands. Following the dedication page, he has a short three lines from T.S. Eliot that pretty much sum up what we aspire to at Inglewood. What life have you if you have not life together? There is not life that is not in community, and no community not lived in praise of God. Thank you for that, and welcome.
Can you hear me? Thank you. Better? Can you hear me? Okay. All right. I want to start just by making a couple of assertions about cities and a point about the building industry and its environmental impact. When I talk about the traditional city, I mean an environment, a walkable mixed-use environment, a walkable environment that contains a variety of uses. But I want to say that regardless of whether a city is traditional or whether a city is modern, that every city consists of a set of overlapping orders, so that every city is simultaneously an environmental order, a demographic order, an economic order, a moral order, and a formal order. And that I would add further that I think that all cities, every city exists in the context of sacred order or not. That last point is disputed. But I would argue that even if the last point is disputed, that there's no disputing that every city is an environmental order, demographic order, economic, moral, and formal order, and it's done better or worse, right? So that it's either done well or it's not done well. The building industry consumes 38% or creates 38% of our CO2 emissions. It consumes 40% of all raw materials that we use, provides 30% of the waste output. Buildings consume 72% of all electrical use, 39% of all energy used, and 14% of all potable water. And I assume that that statistic does not mean the water that people are actually drinking, but the water that is drinkable. Buildings consume 14% of that. So we're talking about a major component of energy consumption with significant implications for the future of natural resources and the environment. There are two sources of my comments today. The first is the Christian tradition of the fulfillment of human history as a heavenly city, articulated for Christians most authoritatively by Scripture as the New Jerusalem, and subsequently by St. Augustine as the city of God. And then the second source is the classical humanist tradition of thinking about the nature and purpose of cities, of which Aristotle is the fountainhead, and in which cities are understood to exist for the sake of the best life for human beings, which is, in this tradition, a life of moral and intellectual excellence lived in community with others. And you can see from the slide here a depiction of these two sources of authority. Next. So I'm grateful for Norman's comments yesterday about creation and the thoughts prompted by that. I want to say something about the place of human beings in the context of creation and argue that man, male and female, is an intermediate being. That we are part of nature, but we transcend nature. And that this fact implies both the ability and the obligation to be stewards of nature. Human beings do not exist outside of nature. If we existed outside of nature, that would have implications for our being either lords of nature who view nature as raw material for our ambitions, and certainly we act that way, but I'm arguing that that's a misunderstanding of our place in nature. But at the same time, it also suggests that if we're understood as being outside of nature, we can understand ourselves mistakenly as being a kind of cancer, as not having a proper place within nature. But the fact that we're part of nature means that that in a certain sense we belong to and are part of nature in the same way that everyone else is. However, we're not only within nature. We're not just within nature. If we were simply within nature, there would be no basis for a critique of our activity and its consequences, because nature simply is what nature does in this view. And so the point that I would make is that we are intermediate beings empirically, right? That we exist within nature, but at the same time transcend nature. And that it's this status, this role, this place of human beings within nature that brings with it our ability to be stewards, brings with it our obligation to be stewards. And so what are the responsibilities of human stewardship of nature? I want to suggest that whatever other responsibilities there are, it involves knowing nature, It involves caring for nature. It involves improving nature. And it involves telling nature's story. Every time I see some kind of documentary on the Science Channel about some sort of underwater explanation, I marvel at the human capacity for exploration, understanding, telling the story of nature. And it seems to me that this is also a critical aspect of our role as stewards of creation. Next. Our role as stewards of nature is hindered, is compromised by our ability to be good stewards of nature is hindered and compromised by our fallen condition. And our fallen condition itself compounds our fallen condition. This is a general crisis that we understand as part of the human condition, that man and nature are fallen, that we are fallen beings. So this is a general crisis that's pervasive, right? It seems to be part of the human condition since the garden. But then there are specific kinds of, I would say this is a general crisis. Sin, our fallen condition, is the general crisis. But there are particular crises of modernity that we're facing today. And some of these have been discussed in our previous conversations and presentations. Massive urbanization and suburbanization. Consequent environmental, social, and cultural disarray. And then there are related social issues that we're facing of a stagnant economy, both locally and globally, declining net birth rates with an increase of births outside of marriage and family, the decline of two-parent families, the decline of the middle class with corresponding concentration of wealth in a new kind of hereditary meritocracy. This is the general condition, our fallen condition next. So this is an image of Lagos, Nigeria from several years ago. It's emblematic of the kind of rapid urbanization that's taking place not only in Lagos, but in cities throughout Latin America, in Africa, in Asia. A huge influx and growth of modern cities. Next. This is a little diagram. We'll come back to this. It has implications. This is an indication of the growth of metropolitan Chicago between 1857 and 2009, where in 1857, Chicago was a city of about 86,000 right here, Lake Michigan. And this is the metropolitan region. By 1873, it was 360,000, and you can see it sort of developing as these small towns along commuter rail lines. By 1900, it was up to 1.7 million. By 1936, it was up to about 4.5 million. But the whole time keeping the same sort of pattern of development that you can see, you know, between 1857 from 85,000 up to 4.5 million. But then from after the Second World War up until the present day, this is what metropolitan Chicago looks like now in terms of land coverage. And this is suburban sprawl. This is what suburban sprawl means. So that all of these rail lines that you can still pick out in the 1936 diagram, all of that is infilled subsequently with automobile sprawl. Next. These are just images of everyday post-1945 suburban sprawl in the United States. Next. This is images of present-day Chicago. And the public face that, and a lot of the public press that Chicago gets is that Chicago has never been better. It's got a great front yard in Millennium Park here. The President of the United States is a Chicagoan. The mayor of Chicago is his former chief of staff. The population of the greater loop between 2000 and 2010 grew by 60,000 people. And so in a certain sense, Chicago has never seemed wealthier or more vibrant. Next. But there are problems in the background. At the same time that the greater loop was growing by 60,000 people, within the city limits of Chicago, the rest of the city lost 250,000 people, lost 250,000 in population for a net loss of about 200,000 between 2000 and 2010. These are images taken from a year ago last April during the third 100-year storm event in the last 5 years and some of their consequences in the city, sinkholes, flooding, and in this case, geysers shooting through the manhole covers on Lawrence Avenue on the north side. These, in some ways, are it's indicative of a couple things. One is ramifications of climate change, but it's climate change in tandem with a historic set of engineering decisions that Chicago has made. And you can see there's a hand. I don't have it included in the slide that the Chicago Project has on this one handout. It shows some of our thinking on this project about the situation with Chicago and the fact that it reversed the Chicago River and problems that has created water related problems ever since. So that's a problem Chicago has to face. Next. This is a graph of declining birth rates from 1909 to 1909 up here to 2009 here. I was raised, I'm of a generation that since 1973 have thought that, along with many of my cohort, that the world had an overpopulation problem. And so the idea that population birth rates, that the birth rates would decline would be a good thing. But what we're starting to see is that it's possible to simultaneously have too many people and not enough people. And that one of the problems, we can say that it's that societies can continue to flourish to a point where the birth rates decline to at least replacement birth rates, but when they fall below replacement birth rates and stay that way for a while, it's a recipe for economic stagnation. And all kinds of other social disruptions that follow from that. And what seems to have happened is that the birth rates have, in fact, they've fallen below and have been below replacement level in the United States for quite a while. And if that's a trend that continues, it's problematic. We have problems anyway because of the huge number of retiring baby boomers relative to the number of employees that can sustain them. I have a Peter Lawler tells his students that if they want to see Social Security and Medicaid continue, that there are two things that they need to do. He says that they need to start having babies now, and he says that they need to start smoking and not quit. Next slide. With respect to Chicago, there's been a dramatic decrease in Chicago in the existence of a middle class. This is a demographic map of Chicago 1970, in which the gray, all of this gray, represents in the wards households with a median family income of between 75% and 125% of the metropolitan area median. In this graph, the dark red represents poverty, which is 0 to 45% of the median family income, and the dark green represents over 200% of the median family income for the region, and then various shades in between. So this is Chicago in 1970. Note the disappearance of the gray, and note the growth in the green and the growth in the red. So it was 1970, next. 1980, next. 1990, next. 2000, next. 2007, which was just before the crash, next. 2012, and next. Okay, so it's 1970, now if you can go back, 2012, actually, go forward again, 2012. Forward again, 1970. Okay. And then this is an image of the an emblematic image of what I call a hypermodern global city. It's an advertisement from Financial Times. It's a collection of high-rises taken from all over the world, assembled in one place to look like Manhattan or Shanghai. But the symbolic content of the image is clear, that the modern city and this kind of architecture is an architecture by and for the economic elite in a global culture. Next. And then this is Chicago, downtown Chicago today. And the image that Chicago is selling itself as a global city. But next. Actually, go back. But what we can see from some of the discussions that I, or some of the points that I've made, and this image is that there's a discrepancy between this kind of culture and what it represents, and the experience elsewhere in the city of Chicago and in the region with respect to things that are not so visible as the Great Loop. Next. So that's, you know, these are our crises, general and specific. The good news, I get to talk about the good news of redemption and salvation, is that it starts here. And so this is a quick little run through of some great art in the Western world that depicts essentials of the creed. Where we go. So for our salvation, Christ was born of the Virgin Mary and became man. Next. He was crucified under Pontius Pilate, suffered death, and was buried. Next. On the third day he arose. Next. He will come again in glory to judge the living and the dead. Next. And his kingdom shall have no end. Next. I believe in the forgiveness of sins, the resurrection of the dead, the life of the world to come. And then from Scripture, and I saw the New Jerusalem descending like a bride adorned for her husband. Next. So if the previous images are images of our, you know, of our beliefs that are revealed to us, of God reaching out to us, there's another way of knowing that is complementary to that, which is our capacity for reason, our capacity for understanding the world. And it's, I would suggest that it's emblematic, this classical humanist tradition of learning, this classical humanist tradition of architecture. It's evident and symbolized in this painting by Raphael in the Vatican, the School of Athens, representing truths discoverable and discovered through human reason, depicted in and represented by classical humanist architecture. Next. So in the School of Athens, the central figures are Plato and Aristotle. Plato on the left, Aristotle on the right. Plato holding the Timaeus, pointing up. Aristotle holding the Ethics, pointing down. Next. And in the detail of Aristotle, from the Ethics, man, when perfected, is the best of animals, but when separated from law and justice, he is the worst of all. And then again, from the Politics, the best life, both for individuals and for cities, is the life of virtue, when virtue has wealth enough for the performance of good actions. Next. So this back to this image of Nigeria, Lagos, Nigeria, and I wanted to come back to it for a reason. Next. This is Chicago in 1900. And the reason that I'm interested in Chicago and showing these images is because Chicago is a historically paradigmatic, is historically paradigmatic and is historically instructive. Next. And this is the comparison. So Chicago 1900 at State and Madison on the left, Lagos, Nigeria in 2009, and here's where the story begins about our engagement with the city of Chicago. Next. If we understand human flourishing as a life of moral and intellectual excellence lived in community with others, can human flourishing occur in a modern metropolitan environment? Can a modern metropolis be reconceived as a range of less dense rural to more dense urban settlements that cumulatively, at the scale of a metropolitan region, attain the local intimacy, formal legibility, and densities of human capital that have historically made cities both central to the dynamics of human achievement, discovery, and excellence, and beautiful places that feel like home? indeed places that anticipate our heavenly home? I want to address these questions by way of both a big picture exercise and some small picture exercises that imagine the future of a specific place, of metropolitan Chicago. The first set of images I'm going to show interventions or proposals or imagining Chicago 100 years out, Chicago in 2109. For Chicago to become this way, there are long-term policy implications, which is why I projected forward, this is a project that I've been working on with graduate urban design students at Notre Dame. But we projected it forward 100 years. We can imagine some things that we think that will make change necessary, but we're projecting it 100 years forward so that we can show something which we think is aspirational. So it has long-term policy implications, which are remote from most of us today. But then I want to show some short-term, smaller-scale interventions that suggest some kinds of immediate, practical kinds of activities that parishes and religious communities today can undertake. Next. No, I'm sorry, go back. So William Cronin's book, Nature's Metropolis, Chicago and the Great West, is a landmark in the long-term cultural project to recover from and move beyond ruthless 20th century applications of Cartesian rationality to how human beings occupy the landscape. Cronin's book occasions aha moments for many readers about several important realities, that cities and landscapes are not independent and competing entities, but rather mutually defining and mutually dependent, that the city itself is best understood as part of an agrarian urban unit, that human beings are not independent of nature, but rather part of nature, and that it is part of human nature to make a variety of human settlement types, including cities, which means that cities, although artifacts, are also in this sense natural. Though we can properly characterize cities as good or bad, as better or worse. 19th century Chicago was both a milestone and a paradigm of the industrial era, a modern megacity that arose virtually overnight in the theretofore pre-modern center of a continent that harnessed uneasily and incompletely the forces of modernity to transform both itself and its pre-existing Western landscape at historically unprecedented scale and speed. Chicago, in the 19th century, became an inland economic giant, a continental nation's center for the sale and distribution of grain, lumber, and meat by virtue of its geographical location, its dominance as a railroad hub, and the entrepreneurial genius of its residents. Cronin's concluding chapter alludes to Chicago's efforts early in the 20th century to figure out, first, what to do with the wealth 19th century Chicagoans had created. Second, how to contain, if not repair, the environmental damage that they had caused. Third, how best to govern themselves, and four, how best to live. That is, philosophical and existential questions about nature, and human settlements that historians, qua historians, cannot answer. Nature's Metropolis correctly identifies human beings as part of nature, but it does not address human exceptionalism, nor does it address questions about obligation and stewardship and their further implications, including their theological implications, that necessarily arise from a consideration of our collective human powers and capacities. Likewise, Nature's Metropolis does not address directly either the meaning of human flourishing or the complex relationship of human flourishing to environmental and economic sustainability, nor does it address questions about urban teleology, that is, the nature and purpose of cities. And finally, though it alludes to the subject in its final chapter, Nature's Metropolis does not address directly the issue of urban form and how urban form is related to ideas of both the city and human flourishing. Happily, however, there is a long intellectual and artistic tradition of classical humanist urbanism that addresses each of these issues. An intellectual tradition as old as Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics and Politics, and an artistic tradition theorized by Vitruvius in the oldest remaining architectural treatise from classical antiquity, the De Architectura, or Ten Books on Architecture. And especially happily for my purposes here, it's a tradition once brought to bear upon Chicago by Daniel Burnham in the 1909 Plan of Chicago that Burnham designed and co-authored with Edward Bennett. The Plan of Chicago is noteworthy for many reasons. It was exemplary in the regional environmental scope of its ambitions, exemplary in its aspiration to preserve metropolitan Chicago's lakefront and forests as public places, and exemplary in its desire for a civic realm of beautiful buildings and spaces that would engage an urban population gathered from all over the world and help foster in them affection for a place where they, their fellow citizens, and their descendants could flourish. Although the Plan of Chicago was sponsored by Chicago businessmen, Burnham envisioned Chicago not simply as a place of business, but rather as both quotidian and sacramental home. Over the course of the 20th century, Burnham's plan succeeded more in its conservation and lakefront park ambitions than in its civic and regional ambitions. But the Plan of Chicago is noteworthy, not least because it was arguably the last great planning proposal of the modern era to attempt to bring classical humanist moral and aesthetic sensibilities, which is to say the concern for beauty and the concern for home, to bear upon the practical problems of a modern metropolitan region. The 20th century successor to classical humanist traditions of architecture and urban design was modernist architecture and city planning, which in Europe began in earnest in the early 1920s, immediately after World War I, and in America began after 1945. Thereafter, modernism quickly became the dominant architecture and planning theory throughout the so-called First World, and with missionary fervor came to establish itself worldwide as a new occupying colonial and imperial power, though the modernists lacked both the self-knowledge and the humane aesthetic ambitions of their predecessor classical humanist culture. In the United States, modernism's most conspicuous fruits were urban renewal of the 60s and automobile-centered suburban sprawl. But modernism's most insidious accomplishment was perhaps its success in establishing as a culture-wide habit of both thinking and practice today's hypermodern utilitarian approach to the built environment. Hypermodern and utilitarian, separating those two, that the hypermodern ambition is aesthetic and the utilitarian is a residue of modernist rationalism. But this approach, in this approach to the built environment, in this context, architects have been encouraged to imagine the value of every building in terms of its formal novelty and to leave the practical matters to the engineers and to the lawyers. Next slide. But let me return to the question with which I began. Can human flourishing, the life of moral and intellectual excellence lived in community with others, occur in a modern metropolitan environment? And can a modern metropolis be reconceived as a range of less dense rural to more dense urban settlements that cumulatively, at the scale of a metropolitan region, attain the local intimacy, formal legibility, and densities of human capital that have historically made cities both central to the dynamics of human achievement, discovery, and excellence, and places that feel like home? I want to point out this slide. This is a little diagram of the world's population concentrated. Here's in gray is the United States. And this is the world population and the amount of land it would occupy, the density of various international cities. So this does not illustrate the amount of additional land necessary to sustain a world population of these densities. But what this says is that at the density of Paris, right, this is Paris, it's the densest of these, and note that Paris is a low-rise city. It's a city of six-story buildings. That you could get the world's population in Louisiana and Arkansas and Mississippi right there. At the density, the world's population in the United States at the density of Paris would occupy that much land. At the density of New York, it would occupy that much. It would occupy Texas. At the density of Singapore, Texas, Oklahoma, Louisiana, the density of San Francisco, similar density, London, a little less dense, and this is what it would look like if the entire world's population was at the density of Houston. That's how much land it would occupy in the United States. But I think the main point that I want to make is that the densest, Paris, which is about 55,000 people per square mile, is done without high-rise buildings, six-story buildings. So next. So to the questions that I asked about human flourishing, the Notre Dame Plan of Chicago 2109 offers a confident yes. As a critique of contemporary Chicago and a proposal to further develop ideas and forms already deeply embedded in both the history of Chicago and a larger history of which Chicago is part, Chicago 2109 employs the 1909 Plan of Chicago specifically, and classical humanist urbanism and Catholic social teaching generally, as reference points for imagining Chicago a century from now and reconceiving it as a humanist alternative to today's allegedly inevitable hyper-modern, high-rise, post-humanist global urbanism. Chicago 2109 envisions a metropolitan Chicago 3.5 times denser than today, and a city of Chicago about 35% denser than today, yet still only 43% of the density of Brooklyn and only 28% of the density of Paris. And Brooklyn has a few high-rise buildings, but not that many. Among the benefits of Chicago's increased density would be a more active and intentional relationship to metropolitan Chicago's immediate landscape. The recovery in metropolitan Chicago of more than 70% of currently developed land and its reversion to agriculture, forest, prairie, and wetlands, and not least, its reversion to permeable surface, as well as a tripling of the amount of open land in the city of Chicago itself. Not least importantly, this increase in density can be accomplished by taking advantage of Chicago's existing public transportation infrastructure in a range of local densities and residential building types and without the need for high-rises. So this is Chicago as it exists today, sprawl through the six metropolitan Chicago. So it's Cook County, Lake County, McHenry County, Kane County, DuPage County, Kendall County, and Will County. That's the thing. It actually extends a little to northern Indiana and southern Wisconsin, but we omitted that. So this is what it looks like today. It occupies the entire area of these seven counties is 4,000 square miles. As sprawl, 54% of the land is occupied, so it's 2,165 square miles. 1,833 square miles are open as agricultural and preserved land, which is 46% of the land. And the total density is about 8.5 million people in 2009. We're projecting a similar population, although what we imagine is that population, we're imagining a similar population in 2109, but thinking that it's going to decline and then rise, so that the whole story of Chicago 2109 is a story of decline and revival. But we're assuming that the population, the gross population is similar today and in 2109. So 54% of the land is occupied. In Chicago 2109, the total developed land is 613 square miles, okay, which is, it occupies 15% of the land, right, instead of 54% of the land. The open land here is 46% of the total area. Here is 85% of the total area. Where the total density here is, in 2009, is 3,900 people per square mile. The total density in Chicago 2109 is 13,800 people per square mile, which is only slightly more dense than what the city of Chicago is today. But you can see the significant difference in land occupation, and again, the creation of considerably more land that is open, that is permeable surface, which has to do with recharging of aquifers, and in addition to the policy proposals that we make with respect to wastewater treatment being done locally, and the re-reversal of the Chicago River, those things that are outlined in that page that I handed out to you but didn't think to include in this presentation. Next. So central to the Chicago 2109 project is the recognition of four identifiable settlement types ranging from more rural to more urban. Settlement types that are defined according to both density and area. These are the more rural settlements of the hamlet and the village, and the more urban settlements of the town and the city. And here my notes are confusing me. The town and the city. Towns and city neighborhoods being larger and denser settlements organized in relationship to rail transit, and they have a natural or agrarian landscape at their edge, while hamlets and villages exist at the edge of or crossing of state and or county roads and are surrounded by either a natural landscape or an agrarian landscape with which they presumably would have a working relationship. And I got myself lost in my own notes here. So we've got hamlets, and these are defined. Hamlet, village, town, and city neighborhood are defined both in terms of area and in terms of density. So that hamlets are less than 40 acres. They have a population density of 4,800 to 8,000 people per square mile, which is comes out to about 3 to 5 dwelling units per acre. Villages are 40 to 640 acres. 640 acres is a square mile. 40 acres is a quarter mile by a quarter mile, okay? And 640 acres is a mile by a mile. So the population density of a village is 4,800 to 12,000 per square mile with densities of three to 7.5 dwelling units per acre. So there's a range. And there's some overlap in the density here so that a town is 1 to 4 square miles with a population density of about 10,000 to 20,000 per square mile and 6 to 12.5 dwelling units per acre. And a city neighborhood is greater than 4 square miles with a population density of 16,000 to 40,000 per square mile, which comes out to 10 to 25 dwelling units per acre. This is all more or less, right? So this is not an exercise in Cartesian rationality in this sense, but it's just a sort of range of the different dwelling types. You can see, you know, the different densities, building densities that you get in plan, and the different kinds of densities that you get in the three-dimensional representation next. Okay, so what I was referring to is that towns and cities are I made a reference to the organization of towns and cities according to existing public transportation lines. Okay, so this is regional mass transit, and this is mass transit in the city of Chicago. Okay, and what you see in brown, and I apologize because this is kind of light compared to this, but if you can see where the brown is located, it's located, you know, on the metro rail lines that extend out to their, you know, current destinations, and we're also proposing a kind of circulator system around the perimeter. But all of the towns, you know, take place along these metro lines, and essentially they're defined by the center of the rail stop a mile out in any direction, so that you're not more than a mile from a transit station. And that beyond that, it's agricultural and rural land. Now, we can talk afterwards. You can ask me about, you know, how we imagine this happening, because it's not, we actually imagine this happening in a kind of natural economic way as a consequence of certain things that are already set. We're not imagining that this is a you know, course of taking of properties. But the organization of towns follows the public transportation. In a similar way, the organization of city neighborhoods and their extent follows the public transportation within the city of Chicago, so that you don't have any developed area that is more than a mile from a transit stop. And our proposal is that everything in between gets reclaimed as open land, whether for agriculture or for forest preserve or for constructed wetlands, water purification, or for commercial forestry. So that's the basic organization of that land use pattern. Next. And this is what it looks like out in the suburbs. So you can see this is a little bit more clearly the rail line and how it centers on the stops here, how it centers on the stops here. But then you've got these are all the towns, and Aurora is a city, but the towns that string along the rail lines. And then you have all of these other hamlets and villages, right, as the rural settlements that are in the landscape in between the rail lines. And so our point is that the rural hamlets and villages orient themselves around existing county and state roads. And so that's the reason that they locate in that and appear the way that they are. But the point is that hamlets and villages are freestanding things that are existing in the context of a natural or agrarian landscape. And the towns are also freestanding, but they tend to be sequential along the rail line. So they're more compact. Next. And then this is a depiction of what it would look like, what it could look like at the interface of the agrarian landscape and the town or village or hamlet settlement. And this is a drawing courtesy of Andres Guani's book, Theory and Practice of Agrarian Urbanism. But you can see the denser urban settlement, and then its transition out into an agricultural landscape. In order to work in a metropolitan context, and in contrast to post-1945 suburbs, each rural and urban settlement type requires, in proximity to commercial, religious, and civic buildings and spaces, a variety of residential building types suited for persons in different stages of life: young children, teenagers, young adults, working families, and retirees. This was the pre-1945 historical norm and can work again if Chicagoans will study, learn from, and improve the unusually good mix of neighborhood housing types developed locally in Chicago prior to 1930. The detached single-family houses, large and small, owner-occupied 2- and 3-flat buildings, 6-flat buildings, 12-unit corner apartment buildings, the 3-story U-court walk-up, and the mid-rise apartment building, allowing for the possible desirability of taller residential buildings on Chicago's lakefront, but leaving it to individual neighborhoods to regulate building heights. The highest residential densities envisioned in Chicago 2109 can be accomplished humanely in buildings of 6 stories or less. Next slide. And if you recall the image of Chicago that I showed earlier, that's the model for this. You'll see it. You can see it has a lot fewer high-rises in this depiction. So what of Chicago as a city of historic high-rise buildings? Chicago 2109 proposes no high-rise demolition, but it does envision an economy and cultural sensibility in which tall buildings will be preserved and maintained to the extent that they are well-built, and above all, to the extent to which they are loved. And what the consequence of that, we think, is that most of the buildings that are standing in the Greater Loop now will not last 100 years, because we don't think that they're well-built enough, and we don't think that they're sufficiently loved. It's a conjecture. Even on occasion, there might be high-rises built new, most likely for important civic structures. Next slide. Like this. However, in Chicago, imagined as a classical humanist city, both by Daniel Burnham in 1909 and in Chicago 2109, the high-rise building is not normative. What are the alleged environmental benefits of high-rise buildings and the need for higher urban population densities to affect a better stewardship of land? It's true that higher-than-present densities have environmental benefits, but not true that density can only be satisfied by high-rises. Paris, as I've said, a city of 6-story buildings, is almost 4 times denser than the city depicted in Chicago 2109. And Paris does not have the lower density, predominantly single-family residential building types that would be most characteristic of the metropolitan regional settlement pattern of hamlets, villages, towns, and city neighborhoods envisioned in Chicago 2109, which also means, note well, that if and when the time comes, metropolitan Chicago has the capacity for substantial population growth within the patterns of land use shown in Chicago 2109. I should say, I said that the scenario that we're imagining here is a period of decline and revival. There's an alternative scenario, which is that if climate change overwhelms the coastal, the coastal United States, Chicago could become the capital of the country, right? In which all bets are off, and Chicago becomes prosperous, and and it's a different kind of thing that we imagine. But this is a very kind of conservative, a deeply conservative kind of proposal that we're a culturally conservative proposal that we're proposing here. So, like the anticipated decline and demise of unloved and poorly built high-rise housing and office buildings, the anticipated decline and demise of Chicago's post-1945 suburbs and their restoration as rural land is not an active policy proposal to shut down suburbs. Rather, the decline of suburbia is imagined as a consequence of fixed near-term demographics and their slow growth or shrinking economic consequences that, in tandem with increased environmental awareness, subsequently result in landscape recovery and restoration as a proactive public policy. And here I want to recall my initial comments about cities as being overlapping environmental orders, economic orders, formal orders, moral orders, that all of these things come into play, and this is how we're imagining one way that it could play out. Relatedly, although we think that high infrastructure maintenance costs of low-density suburban sprawl will ultimately render sprawl economically unsustainable, and because higher-density settlements will require fewer car trips, Chicago 2109 presumes that driving will be less common than it now is. But the elimination of automobiles as conveniences is neither presumed by nor essential to Chicago 2109. What is essential is intelligent land use coordinated with existing public transportation improved, and probably a revision of current land taxation policy, which I've thought about, but I can't go into at this point. So what kind of governmental structure is implied by Chicago 2109? Consistent with the social principles of the dignity of the individual person, communal solidarity and subsidiarity, all principles of Catholic social teaching, and in keeping with American traditions of democratic self-governance, Chicago 2109 presumes two levels of political organization below state and national government. One is the metropolitan region, in this case the existing seven counties of northeastern Illinois, and the other is local political communities of place as found in hamlets, villages, towns, and city neighborhoods. And both would be funded, in our thinking, by a metropolis-wide land value tax. Like I said, can't go into the details of that. What's the likelihood of this political reorganization of metropolitan Chicago? Only time will tell, and not all problems can be solved by politics. But for such a reorganization to prevail, the battles to be fought are both political and cultural. Its most likely alternative, which is in fact the most likely alternative to what we're showing, which is in fact now happening, is almost certainly a two-tiered metropolitan Chicago of elite privilege coexisting with increasing poverty. In contrast, the 21st century history imagined by and depicted in Chicago 2109 is one of productive self-governing communities of place anchored in a local landscape. The metropolitan Chicago it envisions represents a cultural and economic revival on the far side of a near-term but systemic demographically based economic and cultural decline that promises to be our actual immediate future. Nevertheless, its near-term pessimism notwithstanding, Chicago 2109 has been conceived in hope, grounded in Christian anthropology, classical humanism, and American traditions of religious pluralism. American traditions of religious pluralism, local associations, and strong but limited government. Simply and succinctly, if Chicago gets better, it will be as a consequence of disciplined love exercised locally by many persons in and for local places, and of disciplined love's hard demands. So now I have about 30 more slides and no more text. So I'm going to run through them quickly. I don't know where I am time-wise. Probably I've run over it because I always do. But I want to point out this condition right here is something for us to think about. So this is a proposed new high-rise in City Hall and Boulevard. This is the high-rise City Hall and a Boulevard fronted by sacred buildings. A crossing of Burns' proposed civic axis and our proposed sacred cross axis to replace the freeway interchange in Chicago's historic center, to replace the Chicago Circle interchange, for those of you who know Chicago. Next slide. Okay, so this is, again, picking up on the Burnham plan and carrying it forward. This was Burnham's original proposal for a City Hall civic center located at the intersection of Congress Street and Halsted Avenue, right here. This is the proposal from the Plan of Chicago, 1909. This is the three-dimensional depiction of that. It's one grand axis, right, that runs in this direction. Burnham called it the grand axis, the civic axis. This was the civic center of the city of Chicago, and he intended it as a kind of counterweight to the commercial chaos, right, of Chicago in the first decade of the 20th century. He was trying literally to sort of civilize the wild western economic environment of Chicago through the employment of this classical vocabulary. And what he came up with was the civic center. Well, this is what Chicago did for that site, right? These are all at the same scale, but this is what currently occupies that site today, which is the Chicago Circle Interchange, which is the meeting of the Dan Ryan and the Eisenhower Expressway and the JFK in this image right here. Well, our proposal is to restore Burnham's original idea of locating City Hall at that site to reclaim the interstate rights-of-way. In fact, we're proposing to reclaim all of the interstate rights-of-way within the city limits of Chicago and revert them to urban thoroughfares, boulevards, wetlands, so they would still be continuous throughout, and the freeway system would continue to exist, but it would be around the perimeter of the city with the freeways repurposed within the city limits itself. So, but in this spot in particular, we're claiming the interstate rights of way for this proposed new sacred axis, cross axis, which we're showing here next. This idea was informed in part by the work that Burnham did with the Macmillan Commission in Washington, D.C. in the early, before he did the Plan of Chicago, which created the Washington, D.C. that we know today. In the original L'Enfant plan, you had the major axis here on the Capitol building, and you had a cross axis here in connection to the White House. What this plan did was recover sort of the classical intent of that. It extended the axis to create the Lincoln Memorial. It extended this axis to create the Jefferson Memorial. So you've got this axial, cross-axial relationship in Washington that Burnham did. And so we're kind of copying that idea for our own purposes here next. So this is Burnham's proposal for City Hall next. This, again, that view, this is City Hall there on the grand axis next. This is our kind of parti diagram for the cross axis. If this is the civic axis, we're restoring Burnham's civic axis, and we're proposing a new sacred axis next. That was the diagram of that. This is the area within which that occurs. Here's the Kennedy Freeway coming down here, Circle Interchange. Here you can see the freeways as they run through next. And then this is our proposed intervention. You see the freeways have gone away next. And this is our, axis, cross axis, next. And so what we have are a set of mixed-use buildings. I mean, the axis, cross axis relationship establishes essentially a new neighborhood in the historic center of Chicago at six-story density of mostly background buildings that are mixed-use, residential, but with sites for 12 sacred buildings that front the avenue. Now, it's important. You notice that on the civic axis, it's terminated by the city hall, by a single building, a single high-rise. On the sacred axis, there is no terminus, because part of what we want to do, and this is 1.2 miles and extends further, is that we don't want to locate any object on the sacred axis. It's void, it's infinite, but it is fronted and served by these various religious buildings, which in fact, we're a Roman Catholic school, we make truth claims about Christianity and Catholicism. But in the context of American religious freedom and religious pluralism, we've taken as examples, we presume that there would be a mosque, Catholic churches, Protestant churches, Orthodox churches, Buddhist temples, Mormon temples that would be located, on these sites. And these are some of the precedents for that. Next. And this is a perspectival view down that sacred axis, which in a certain sense is just this kind of quotidian, everyday, you know, occupiable public space, but also lends itself to the kinds of formal ceremonial religious events that occur liturgically, you know, in sacred time. Next. And then this is that view again, the aerial view of that same condition. Next. And then this is what it looks like, aerial view looking east to Chicago. So here's the civic axis. Here's the proposed new city hall. And here's the sacred axis right here. And it's sort of modeled on the Columbian Exposition of 1893. That's a whole other sort of historical little story and reference. Next. Okay, and then the last set of things that I want to show very quickly are things that parishes can do to do the little tiny pieces that is where all local sense of place and the church as a center of common life need to begin. And this is, I think, in the other handout you've got, there is a 3-page essay in it by a student, a graduate of the Notre Dame architecture program, Will Dowdy. I think it's called Ecclesiastical Sprawl Repair. But he discusses the two projects that I'm going to show. But this is a little diagrammatic drawing that I did about 10 or 15 years ago. I want you to sort of keep in mind a particular size of land, 6 to 15 acres, as a significant piece of property. 6 to 15 acres is about the size of a historic Benedictine monastery with its walled community, its church, its various outbuildings, its cloister garden, its living accommodations for the monks, the refectory, its various agricultural things, and its animal husbandry. And outside the wall, they were tending to agriculture. So monks could get a monastery on 6 to 15 acres. In London, if you know, any of you know London and the west end of London, it's characterized by a set of residential squares, which is how London grew over a period of 200 years, where aristocratic landowners would hire a developer contractor to and give them 6 to 15 acres to build on, and they would build row houses, townhouses, organized around a square, and they would build a house for the aristocratic landowner, would retain title to the property, but would let the developer sell or rent the other houses on 99-year leases. And it's, you know, it's the way that the aristocrats just increased their wealth in London. But in theory, churches could do that if you wanted to, you know, if you wanted to increase your wealth for other things. So 6 to 15 acres for a London residential square. 6 to 15 acres is what most suburban churches occupy today, with a church, maybe a school, a big parking lot, I want to say a big-ass parking lot, and a retention pond. That's a standard size. And then this is a little diagram of what can be put on 10 acres. A church, seats 700, an elementary school, a square and plaza, and 41 private lots in 10 acres. Now, if you develop each lot as a single dwelling unit, you're getting 4 dwelling units per acre, because this 10 by 10 is I'm sorry, no. This is 4 acres. Did I say? I'm sorry. This is 10. Yeah, this is 10 acres. So you're getting 4 dwelling units per acre if these are just single family houses, which is a density of about the size of a hamlet. If you were to make all of these buildings 2 flats, or if you were to say there was a main building and an outbuilding, a coach house with another dwelling unit, you've doubled the density and made it, you know, at the sort of in between range of a village or a town. And if you made them 3-story buildings, then you're at the higher end density of a town. So you can get a lot of density and mix of uses within just 10 acres on 40 fairly generous building lots. Next. Oh, so here's, yeah, we've seen this graphic. So, it could easily fit within the density dimensions of these. Next. And so this is what that looks like in 3 dimensions on just an abstract site. It's 660 feet by 660 feet. And it's just, it's entirely abstract. It was an entirely abstract exercise. Next. So these are the two projects that show up in Will Dowdy's article on sprawl repair. The first is a thesis project, again by a Notre Dame graduate, for a site in St. Charles, Illinois. Really, this is a site right there of St. John Newman Parish. This is their church. This is their parking lot and retention pond. This is Route 64, a main drag, and this is Kirk Road, if you know St. Charles. These are two major intersections. So this is the area. He extended it to cover this. Next. And so this was what he proposed to fill in with that, to provide alternative ways to think about their parking, but also to think about other kinds of development that could take place where the church becomes a center of neighborhood development. Next. This is the building that he designed for that, and just the little sort of building complex of the church and the school and the square and the entrance. Next. And this is sort of what that looks like. This is the area of the church property here. So he's proposing development on the other side of the road, and he's proposing development over here as well. But he's sort of extending this idea of what you can do on suburban land with respect to churches as centers of new neighborhood, as the nucleus of a new neighborhood. Next. And then finally, this is the last project, which is this is a proposal done by Milton Grenfell, a classical architect in Washington, assisted by Eric Bootsma, who was another graduate of Notre Dame. That takes an existing suburban parish church in McLean, Virginia. This is St. John the Beloved Parish. This is the church, kind of post-Vatican II, church in the round, kind of horizontal church. This is a building. It's easy to miss that this is a building. So this is a current view of the church's property. Next. Okay, so they went through five phases in proposing a complete transformation of the property, and they phased it in such a way so that the church could actually make property available for development, that they could develop and sell to raise the funds to build their new church and their new school. So it was a matter of it was a self-funding development opportunity. So the first thing that they did was, on this given site, they simply put in a new street grid, right, around the existing buildings, and they parked on the street so that they didn't lose any parking from their original suburban layout. But they used the street grid for parking, so they didn't lose any net parking. They simply, you know, arranged it in a set of streets and blocks. Next. This was phase two, where they put a little new commercial core building at the southern end of the site, some new residential here in yellow, in this corner, in this corner, in this corner. And you can see, you know, I mean, just compare the, you know, this is the street grid, this is the beginnings of the development of that. So this is phase two. Next. Okay, here's phase three from phase two. They demolished this building, right, and they finished the residential row over here, and they build the first phase, of a new school. Next. So in phase four, they build a new church. Actually, the old church is still there. They build a new church in phase four, and it's rectory and outbuildings. They complete the school, so now you've got an entire complete new school and a new church fronting a public square. Next. And then the final phase is that they complete the commercial core. They demolish the old church and finish the residential. This is all part of the commercial core right here. Next. So that this is the existing property. This is phase one, phase two, phase three, phase four, phase five. Next. And so you go from this to this. Next. This is a three-dimensional representation of this. Right? So there's the commercial building, here's the church, here's the school, here's the new housing here and along here. Next. And so you go from that to that. So, and again, that's like about a 10-acre piece of property. So I better stop. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Phil.
You bet.
Can you hear me?
Okay.
so at your tables, thinking about this vision for Denver,
there's a question
that is posed on your sheet, which is, how can you, at your existing churches, in your church communities, how can you begin to enact some of the things that we see in the vision for Chicago? And one of the suggestions that's given is, in the next 5 years, could you get 10% of your congregation within walking distance?
I think Reba Place already qualifies.
We've got quite a few communities here that already are doing better than that. But think about how you can use your church as a starting point, as we just saw, for increasing urban density and opening up space around it for agrarian space and wild space. So I want you to discuss that at your tables, and then we'll draw back together. So we can have time to continue the conversations later on around our dinner tables, but it's time to bring the conversation together. So is anything percolating at your table that you would like to share with the room?
I mean, this is kind of a question for Philip, I guess, but so we saw kind of the vision for the whole metropolitan area, the 2109 plan, and then we also saw the kind of really micro scale of the parish, the 10-acre plot. But kind of what is sort of the in-between sort of narrative of how you kind of move from the very, very micro parish area to and how does that transition happen?
It's a great question. In fact, I was just having a conversation with someone privately. That was the question, and it was something that we thought about and we imagined and we've done in drawings, but I couldn't make it as part of the presentation. It has to do with the decline of suburbia and sort of how does land that's now occupied by the suburbs become open land that's agricultural land, forest land, commercial forestry, prairie, and hamlets and villages. How does that happen? I think that it happens, at least that what we're imagining, the way that happens, is that suburbia will decline most immediately and primarily by virtue of demographic trends. The buildings that make up suburbia tend to be larger buildings. We have smaller families. They tend not to be particularly well built. They're the areas that hit particularly hard in the mortgage crisis, the subprime mortgage crisis. But the main thing has to do with the uneconomic unsustainability of the infrastructure required to support suburbia. That it was built, it was financed originally in the 60s by the federal government, who paid for it, turned it over to the municipalities when it went through a 30-year life cycle. And I should say, if you want to read more about this, the website to read is a website called strongtowns.org, and it's operated by out of Minnesota by a guy by the name of Chuck Marone. Done really some good analytic analyses of these things. But after the first 30-year cycle, when it had to be replaced, municipalities floated bonds to do that. The problem is that the densities don't provide enough tax revenue to maintain these. So now the crisis is coming, the infrastructure crisis is coming, they're in the third generation of replacement. The old bonds aren't paid off. Municipalities are strapped. And there's this mortgage crisis. And that seems to be something that, for demographic reasons, the banks are going to wind up owning a lot of property, municipalities are going to wind up owning a lot of property. So what we're imagining, I think, in our scenario is that banks, municipalities, philanthropists purchase this property and essentially put it in trust so that it reverts to agricultural land or other agrarian purposes. It doesn't mean you could never build in those areas, but any building that would take place, any human settlements that would take place in those areas between the towns organized on the rail lines would occur at the crossroads of state and county roads, which we presume would continue to, you know, to be maintained, but they would be limited in size. And obviously, since the intersections only occur in certain places, and since you're limited in size, it means that a large portion of that land now currently occupied by suburbia would be open land.
Let's thank Philip for an